We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia, along with the federal government, entered into an agreement in 1983 to clean up the Chesapeake Bay. The states of Delaware, New York, and West Virginia joined the partnership years later. During the past 41 years, strategies and plans have been implemented to reduce pollution and restore the health of the bay. Some have been successful, while others have fallen short of their goals. Next year, 2025, was set as a deadline to meet several of those goals in the restoration plans. It has the states and the federal government thinking about what comes next. Should the priorities change? Has climate change become a bigger factor than the bay restoration itself? How will individual stakeholders like municipalities and farmers be impacted by any changes? To discuss these issues and more is Harry Campbell, Director of Science Policy and Advocacy with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation here in Pennsylvania. Harry, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Scott. Thanks.
I always have to think that somebody may be hearing this for the first time. So let's provide a little bit of history. Go back to 1983. What prompted action to try to restore the Chesapeake Bay?
Well, what happened was actually starting even well before that, before I was born, back in the 1960s or so, folks started to notice that the bay of old was just not appearing to be as in good health as it once was. The fisheries are less than they were. There's sick fish, dying fish. The crab population was plummeting, oysters, and the water started to look a little funky in terms of clarity and everything. And so over the course of time, as the environmental awakening occurred in the late 1960s and then through the 70s with the formation of EPA in the United States, scientists really began to study what is going on within the Chesapeake Bay and why. And they determined that one of the primary causes of the challenges within the Chesapeake Bay that people were observing was the fact that there was far too much nutrient and sediment pollution entering in the Chesapeake Bay. Simultaneous to that, we were taking too much out of the Chesapeake Bay. Too many of the living resources that acted as those natural filters were being removed at the same time, resulting in a perfect storm of pollution and extraction in the Chesapeake Bay that was resulting in the formation of a myriad of things, including what are known as dead zones, areas of low or no dissolved oxygen in the water, sufficient to support aquatic life. So in the early 1980s, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia at that time all got together and said, we have to do something about this because we're all part of this 64,000 square mile drainage area of water that flows to the Chesapeake Bay. We all have a role and a responsibility in trying to do something about this. Let's do it. And they got together and signed what is known as the first Bay Agreement. And that Bay Agreement established essentially goals as far as pollution reduction and resource management into the future to help, quote unquote, save the bay.
So what were some of those goals?
Well, probably the one that is the primary that was also most important, I think, for Pennsylvania was collectively we agreed to a reduction of pollution in the form of nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment of 40% based on baseline numbers from the early 1980s based on monitoring and things of that nature. So that was one of the primary goals. And then the secondary goals were more protection and management activities around those living resources like the striped bass, like the oysters, like the crabs, so as to help provide a more stable and healthy population for reproduction and growth of the economy and in the living resource.
So how did Pennsylvania in particular contribute to some of the pollution in the bay?
Sure. Pennsylvania, actually, half of Pennsylvania, the middle part of Pennsylvania's lands drain into local rivers, streams, and ultimately the Chesapeake Bay through the Susquehanna River and the Potomac River, a portion of the Potomac River, as well as some streams actually in the eastern part of the state that go directly into the Chesapeake Bay. But half of Pennsylvania drains to the Chesapeake Bay through those three mechanisms. The Susquehanna River actually provides 18 million gallons of water per minute on average to the Chesapeake Bay, flowing into the Chesapeake Bay. It is the largest source of fresh water entering into the Chesapeake Bay on an annual basis, on an average year. And unfortunately, it's also the largest source of nitrogen pollution. That's a form of those nutrients. Those nutrients that cause the problem are phosphorus and nitrogen. And nitrogen is the big one for the Chesapeake Bay, and Pennsylvania is the largest source of it. And then we contribute a lot of good, but oftentimes a lot of challenges to the health and condition of the Chesapeake Bay because of it.
So nitrogen and phosphorus, where were they coming from in Pennsylvania?
Well, they're nutrients, elements, right?
Right.
They're natural.
Mm-hmm.
But nature seeks equilibrium. And in order to support our crops and our, the growth of agriculture and the demands of the consumer, we as a country have created farm bills and expectations in the marketplace for a lot of food cheaply. And one of the aspects to do that, to support our population, is to put a lot of nitrogen on the ground to grow a lot of things. Simultaneously, because of our demand for meat and cheap eggs and pork and cattle and beef and things of that nature, we also intensified our agriculture with a lot more animals in smaller concentrated areas. So, and what do animals do? Well, they eat and poop. And when they eat a lot of nutrients to support their growth, they extract a lot of that in their excrement. And that contains a lot of nitrogen in and of itself. So now all of a sudden we're putting more nitrogen on the land. We're concentrating nitrogen in the form of our the poop of our animals. And oh, by the way, the population is growing too, and we're doing it too. But we built wastewater treatment plants and started nutrient management activities to try to start to manage that. But that's how that gets introduced into the environment, in addition to atmospheric deposition from things like coal-fired generation plants. And then finally, I'll just add that we put it on the land willingly because we like to keep up with the Joneses and have those really lush green lawns as well. So those are the major sources of where nitrogen is coming from in a concentrated way.
So what were the priorities for restoration over the years?
Well, first and foremost, it's changed, actually. The evolution has changed. But when you look at what those sources are, we have a couple of major categories. Agricultural runoff through the activities of agriculture. We have wastewater treatment plants, which from our suburban and urbanized areas. And then we have this other sector of stormwater runoff. The runoff from our impervious areas, our built lands, the subdivisions and strip malls throughout the watershed. Those are the three largest sources of human-influenced nitrogen pollution to the Chesapeake Bay, as well as our local rivers and streams.
So 41 years since the initial agreement between the three states and the District of Columbia, and three other states are involved now. But 2025, a lot of goals were set for 2025. Some goals were met. Some goals were successful in being met. Some weren't. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's start with, quickly, which goals were met?
Well, first and foremost, Pennsylvania has done a stellar job in upgrading our wastewater treatment plants to meet their goals and objectives by the end of 2025. In fact, we're exceeding them as a state. And that's no small task.
We have, yeah, it cost a lot of money.
It costs a lot of money. We have over 200 wastewater treatment plants that were covered by the initial phase of all of that work back starting in the around 2010, a little earlier. And that has significantly improved or otherwise helped Pennsylvania in terms of meeting its overall Bay objectives. And that has been largely across the board as well in the other states as well. They have a little bit of a different situation there. They have larger wastewater treatment plants. We have a large number of smaller wastewater treatment plants, but nonetheless, that's been successful across the board. We've made significant progress in a lot of places, including on dealing with certain types of agricultural activities, the runoff and things of that nature from those areas. Not to the pace, however, that we had promised to in those Chesapeake Bay agreements and the other, what we call the Clean Water Blueprint, which is what's known as a TMDL, or the scientific answer to how much pollution
TDML,
is too much.
TDML, what's the stamp?
TMDL, total maximum daily load.
Right.
And that is essentially the scientific answer to how much pollution is too much. And based on that, in those Bay Agreements, and starting in 2010, the partners decided that we will get allocations. We'll break that total up into, well, how much is the too much pollution in the Bay? Then we'll proportionalize it based on, you know, how much we each partner contributes to the states, and then we'll develop plans to implement to achieve the reductions associated with making that allocation. And so there's been success there, like with the wastewater treatment plants. Certain types of agricultural activities have had significant improvements. Well, we still have a lot more to go. And unfortunately, we've had challenges collectively across the board on the urban and suburban stormwater runoff equation for a number of reasons. And that's probably been one of the bigger challenges as well. That's outstanding. But right now, though, there's a real rich opportunity in terms of continuing that momentum into the future.
The goals that were set with a deadline of 2025, as we said, some were met, others aren't. Mm. It's disappointing to a lot of people. As you said just before the break, maybe a good time to reset. All right, mm-hmm. There are a lot of people talking about resetting. And one of the things they're talking about is, should the priorities change? I mean, I understand that a lot of the plans over the years have been for deep water Chesapeake Bay, the wildlife, what was living in the deep part of the bay. Now there are people talking about, well, what about the people living along the shorelines or in those communities along the shorelines? What about the shallow water? Right. So, first of all, explain what's the difference between prioritizing deep water and what some people are talking about, shallow water and people living along those communities.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I think it's important to recognize that that goal of implementing the practices to, quote unquote, save the bay by the end of 2025 is a deadline, but it's not the finish line. And even when that date was established, the partners recognized how challenging it would be to meet it, but promised to do what they could to accelerate the pace of implementation to improve local water quality in order to meet those Chesapeake Bay obligations. In the context of the deep water, if you think about the bay and you think about it in a cross-sectional way, you have a very unique ecosystem. Actually, it's fundamentally different structurally than the sister estuary right to the east of us in the Delaware Bay. And that difference in the form and function of the Chesapeake Bay does a number of things, including making it one of the most productive in terms of living resources estuaries ever to have known to have existed. And it's because of that complex mixture of all those little shallow areas and the nooks and crannies that they form that are so critical to the young of the year. They provide that habitat for young little fish, crabs, and other critters that are so important that grow up and get big and become economic engines and cultural icons in the Chesapeake Bay region, like the blue crab and all the oysters. Well, those shallow areas are the breeding ground and the bedrock of that ecosystem. Those deep water areas, though, are the troughs. And in fact, if you remove the water of the Chesapeake Bay, that deep water trough is the old riverbed of the Susquehanna River as it would go flowing to what would become the Atlantic Ocean. With the ending of the Ice Age, the last ice age about 14,000 years ago, sea level rise occurred, and the bay formed as we know it today. That deep water area is the most challenging to attain and maintain dissolved oxygen levels sufficient enough to support aquatic life. Because if you think about how densities, and we all learned about densities hopefully in our science classes when we were going through school, but fresh water is lighter than salt water. And the Chesapeake Bay is a mixture of salt and fresh water. On top, there's fresh water, and it's pushing out towards the Atlantic Ocean. It's constantly pushing to the ocean. Salt water, however, is pushing up into the Chesapeake Bay. And it is on the bottom area because it's more dense. And so when we have too many nutrients that enter into the Chesapeake Bay and during the summers then cause a eutrophication, which is a fancy term for saying an algal bloom explodes, that pea soup looking green kind of stuff. And as that algae dies off, it falls and goes into those saltwater areas, which are lower and deeper, and consumes dissolved oxygen along the way. And it settles in those deep water areas. So the theory was that if you develop plans and implement them in order to maintain dissolved oxygen in the deep water areas, then the rest of the Chesapeake Bay should be healthy as well. But we're finding that, well, a number of things happen when you do that, including the fact that it may not be the case that things are as stable or resilient in the rest of the watershed and the Chesapeake Bay if you fixate just on the deep water areas.
Okay, so I think mm-hmm. people can follow that, but what about people who have suggested let's focus on the shallow water?
Mm-hmm. So the shallow waters, because of, as I mentioned earlier, the bedrock, the breeding ground for all those little critters, are critically important to creating a more diverse, dynamic, robust, and resilient Chesapeake Bay. And so in addition to that, they're the areas that oftentimes can respond much more quickly. Meaning so that when we do improve local water quality, when we do things on in our watersheds to help protect living resources and reduce nutrients and sediments to Chesapeake Bay, it's going to be those shallow areas that are going to respond more quickly and significantly than looking at and just fixating on those deep water areas, because those deep water areas are going to represent the accumulation of a lot of work in others. So you actually get shortened that time frame in terms of ecological response while simultaneously creating, again, that additional diversity for those critters.
Another part of the discussion is that the emphasis shouldn't be on the vast reduction of nutrients mm-hmm. as much. I mean, now that doesn't sound right to the layman, but what would that do if there was less attention, less priority on reducing nutrients?
So there's a number of things that we believe that should happen when we start to think about, well, what does this look like into the future, this effort to save the bay? We've developed these five pillars that we believe are critical to entering into the next phase of the Chesapeake Bay effort. And one of the things that has occurred over the course of time during these efforts is that we've kind of started to fixate on bean counting. And what I mean by that is how much of this, how much of that, how much did we do an acre of that, how many linear feet of that, and lost sight of the outcomes. So one of the five pillars we have, those five pillars are focus on the outcomes, meaning not just did we reduce a pound of nitrogen based on what a computer model tells us or based on how much linear feet of this or that we've installed, but focus in on the outcome in terms of like what is the living resource response? Did it improve trout habitat? Did it create a situation where we have more young of the year striped bass or other types of living resource responses? Then, of course, we have to promote innovation and focus in on people and do a number of other things, like even building those partnerships. But by looking at the outcome instead of the widget or the bean counting, we can then really start to measure and, I think, improve and focus in on the things and the places and practices that improve water quality, but also the ecosystem at large.
We only have about 90 seconds left. climate change. In 1983, that was a term where global warming was something you never heard of. Today, there are those who are saying that, well, maybe the restoration of the bay should take a back seat to trying to mitigate climate change. What about that?
The two are inextricably linked. The effort to try to mitigate climate change, as well as save the bay and our local rivers and streams and watersheds, you can't separate the two. The climate change and the responses to it, regardless of what you believe are the causes, it's causing and contributing and increasing the amount of runoff and the pollution that enters our local rivers and streams in the Chesapeake Bay. By focusing in on the types of practices that build that resiliency, tree plantings, cover crops on our agricultural areas, forested riparian buffers, and tree canopy in our suburban and urban areas, not only does that actually help mitigate the impacts of climate change, but simultaneously is improving our local rivers and streams as well as the Chesapeake Bay as well. It's all tied together.
And the local streams and rivers, I mean, that is a big part of this because it's tangible. Everyday people can see something. If their local stream, you know, the waterway that's closest to them, if they see it being cleaned up, it's not like this big thing, the big picture Chesapeake Bay cleanup. It is tangible. I mean, is that something, and we only have about 30 seconds left, is that something that is important to this?
Critically important, especially in Pennsylvania. It's, as you said, it's tangible, it's measurable, and it's relatable. Mm.
Harry Campbell is the Director of Science Policy and Advocacy with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Pennsylvania. Harry, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.